For a minimum, that's still a very minimum number of chemicals in the water. Would not include things like pesticides and organics, for example. That would be much, those would be more expensive.
Thank you.
All right, very good. If there's no one else at this point, we will proceed to the next item. And that would be to the Minnesota Chloride Management.
Mr. Chair.
We're still on the legislative recommendations.
One of the other recommendations deals with chloride. We'll talk about that in more detail later, but
right.
Ms. Nissen from Stop Over Salting has some testimony that she would like to share about that topic. So Sue, are you here?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Very good. Please proceed, Ms. Nissen.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sue Nissen. I'm a Minnesota water steward and a member of Stop Over Salting. We need legislation to reduce chloride pollution. Nearly a million tons of chloride is being used in Minnesota every year. And for a chemical as toxic, corrosive, and potent as chloride, nearly a million tons is an immense amount. But most worrisome to Stop Over Salting is chloride's permanency. Our lakes, rivers, and groundwaters are increasingly salty every year, and we need to start reducing at the sources. And we ask that you reduce two of those leading sources in legislation next year. Those would be road salts and water softeners. And they can be substantially reduced, we believe, and without the public expecting any less service in the areas of winter safety and soft water. So just to go over them, to reduce chloride from rope salts, we support legislation to fund MPCA's smart salting training. The reason why, this training is hands down the biggest positive that Minnesota has going for chloride reduction. Stop Over Salting volunteers, we're all certified in smart salting, and we witness the stunning training results. They are getting 30 to 70% reductions after training in chloride use. And currently the program has no dependable funding source. Yet we really need our winter maintenance professionals trained. So we're asking that you please support legislative authority for the MPCA to charge a fee for these trainings and for the MPCA to receive some money from the general fund for these trainings. We also support road salt legislation that would reduce that by standardizing the labeling requirement on package de-icers. So homeowners and applicators that go to the local store or to a distributor to buy packaged de-icers are educating themselves about chloride. They use the claims, the ingredients, and the directions found on those packages, just like many consumers do. But in this case, that's a problem because that package information isn't regulated, it isn't standardized, it's set by the individual manufacturer. And sometimes we've found that it's not even true. We've seen claims like eco-friendly, pet-friendly, even salt-free, when the product actually is chloride-based, and we've called the manufacturer to check on it. Minnesotans need accurate information about their de-icer packaging in order to know what to do and how to reduce chlorides. Please support some legislation that would develop and implement standardized labeling on all the packaged de-icers used in Minnesota. And lastly, water softening. That's another big salt chloride source. And it's important to reduce that older inventory of those non-smart or poorly functioning water softeners in homes and businesses. So we're asking that you please support some legislation to sunset the purchase of the non-smart technology and some money to for grants that expedite the purchase of the newer, smarter technology, which is really going to get us to reduction. Mr. Chair, members, thanks so much. You have a busy day. I appreciate your time. There is a letter posted to the committee site with more information. We ask that you please support legislation this upcoming session to reduce road and water softener salts at their source. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nissen. Anyone have a question for Ms. Nissen at this point?
Mr. Chair, my hand is raised. It's Heintzman.
Oh, yes. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've been hearing a lot about some of these challenges for quite some time now. And one of the big conversation pieces over the last few years has been for the private applicators. Obviously, that's a huge amount of chloride that's being put on sidewalks, parking lots, so on and so forth. I didn't hear you mention anything about them and about the biggest issue facing that relative to liability to the testifier. I guess I'm asking, have you all just given up on that piece of this? Because it sounds like we're hearing mandate after mandate after mandate, as opposed to some of the opportunities to make some real inroads in a private sector salt application, chloride application.
Representative Heintzman and members. It's been a tough go on the limited liability piece. There have been a lot of legislators on different sides of that, and I'm not sure where we stand in that, especially after how COVID ended up the session last year. With private applicators, liability is an issue, but also just the fact that they aren't in training is an issue. So both of those are going to help reduce the amount that our private applicators are using. And you are right. I mean, it would be great to have liability protection, but can we get that through? And it would be great to have them in training, whether or not they have liability protection, because they can reduce and keep their property safe for sure. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My follow-up would be, I guess, two things. Number one, part of what you're advocating for is training. So I'm a little confused by the idea that we couldn't continue to work on this issue. And I think it could easily be done in a bipartisan way. And I think it needs continued pressure. And I guess my comment would be, second, then, you know, I guess I'm really disappointed that that is no longer a priority in your organization. And, you know, it's not nice to say, but in some respects, I think I would make the argument that you've succumbed to the agencies and a number of the other lobby groups asking you to be quiet on this issue. We need to continue talking about the liability element. And if we're going to advocate for training amongst troubled times relative to COVID and such, I don't think that that's an argument not to pursue this.
Ms. Nissen?
Representative Heintzman and members, I would be happy to talk about the liability issue. I just have to say to you, honestly, I'm a volunteer, and where to put my time and how to make the most difference on chloride is a struggle. And to be honest, I put countless hours in on it. So if there is a way, if there is a bipartisan way, Representative Heintzman, to get liability legislation through, I'd like to talk to you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman, anything further?
Yeah, I'll just follow up with a final comment. I think that there's always a way. It's a matter of whether or not legislators and advocates and even those in the lobby groups are willing to put their heads together and find a way. And on this issue, I certainly understand, and I wouldn't diminish the impact that you have as a volunteer, and I understand wanting to see results, but as organizations try to figure out how to move forward, I really hope that we don't put the biggest element in this opportunity, because this is the low-hanging fruit. There always is going to be an over-application of chloride when people are afraid they're going to be sued. To pursue this in a sort of a one-size-fits-all approach statewide, like for example, and when you're talking about water softeners, when you go to many of the small towns around the state of Minnesota, we could be talking about thousands of years before the chloride issue becomes a problem due to water softeners, but then they would be required to purchase equipment that's significantly more expensive because the state decided we're going to handle this in a way that is a mandate and creates complications and hardship in places it doesn't need to. So I know it's belaboring the point, but I just really want to encourage anyone that's working on the chloride issue to look at all aspects and try to avoid as best we can the political discussion that I guess that hurts us. And my hat is off to you as a advocate and as a volunteer. Good job. Just please don't give up on this.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Heinzman.
Next we'll go to Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This message or this question isn't for Susan, but rather for Mr. Stark. Mr. Stark, it's been a while ago, but I sent you some information on a study that's been going on in Canada and in Scandinavia, and that was the use of wood chips in place of salt. And in Canada and in Scandinavia, they're using primarily sand and wood chips. And it's a very low-cost way that could help us, I think, a great deal. And Lord knows we have plenty of wood chips here in Minnesota for lots and lots and lots of reasons. So I would like to see if we could share that video and share that information with the members of the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Poston, thank you for that. I do have that, and I made some contact with those people. I'd be happy to share that. It's difficult for us to do this, I think, virtually, but yeah. Can certainly share it with the members. And that's a point we should discuss. Mr. Chair, with regard to limited liability, that's a clause that we have retained in the package of proposed bills that's before you. So that's still included in there, Representative Heintzman, and that's something for this group to consider.
Representative Poston, you're sure that the Scandinavian process doesn't involve lutefisk juice, does it? Because I think we have another contaminant on our hands at that point.
If it does, I'd like to steer away from that, Senator.
Okay, very good. Representative Fisher. Okay, I thought I saw Representative Fisher's hand up. All right.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, there you go.
All right, super. I thought I unmuted myself and it didn't work there. So I want to say, first of all, thanks to Ms. Neeson for all the work she's done on the salting issues over the years. Very much appreciate it. And as was highlighted by Mr. Stark, I do want to draw attention that it looks like that bill number 2, the proposed water quality protection, would cover a number of the chloride issues in it. And I would imagine that when a bill like that comes through, it's getting a number of the issues all wrapped together. And I think that's a great way to go, is making sure that we're not leaving anything behind. And I would imagine that Ms. Neeson will be helping us on that and testifying for that as it goes forward as we bring these bills out. So I want to say once again, thank you, Ms. Neeson, for her help on that, and mention that I am very happy to see that these items, not just the limited training for the salt and liability for the salt applicators, but some of the other chloride issues were also included in bringing these bills together.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Mr. Stark, I don't see any other hands up right now. Please proceed with the discussion you need as it relates to the listing of bills that you provided us.
Certainly. Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Good testifiers here. I appreciate them addressing some of these issues. You have, as I mentioned, you have a packet that covers these issues in much more detail. I would appreciate some discussion of those either here. I know our time is short today, either here or if you want to communicate with me about any of the contents of that package. But what I would like today would be your permission to proceed with getting those bills in order so that at our next meeting, we'll have them in order in the way, based on your comments, if you can provide them for me and we can act on those as a group, either now or at our next meeting when they are more, they're formalized.
I think, Mr. Stark, I would prefer to see the bills in their final form before we have too much discussion on them, or unless someone has something that they wish to say that might modify what's been talked about so far. How does the rest of the committee feel? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Appreciate the opportunity. There's a couple of questions I have. I think it's great that the bills have been brought together by subject area here to help streamline the process. I think that will help improve the chances of getting hearings as we go forward. And with the challenges that we have, it might make it a little bit easier for say, 7 bills get heard versus 30 bills getting heard. The other question I have is in terms of the process is I know that our committee sunsets at the end of this month, and it's going to take probably a meeting or might take a couple of weeks before we're going to be able to come together officially in January, I think. But I want to double check with Director Stark to see where we are in that process and what he knows that the timelines might be. Because and I also know that we have at least one member of this group that is not coming back.
Mr. Stark.
And Mr. Chair and members, thanks, Representative Fisher, bringing that up. We have discussed this with the chairs and with the executive director of the LCC. So Michelle Weber, the director, is prepared to bring that forward to the LCC at their first meeting, but I believe that won't be until into January. So I guess the question is, can we move forward after December in some form, although technically the subcommittee will sunset at the end of the year?
I would like to make a suggestion is that we continue getting things pulled together and maybe informally, because we can't come together in, formally, but informally, if we could somehow come together after the first of the year. I do know that I've spoken to Speaker Hartman. She does have the gavel for the LCC this year, and she is very supportive of trying to get us together and things going right as soon as possible. But she said, even in the best of times, it would probably be mid-January before they're going to be able to meet, which means it's going to put it almost the end of January before we're going to be able to come back and do things officially. And depending who's all on the committee at that point in time, may have a little bit of redoing going on. And the reason I'm suggesting maybe trying to see if we can do something informally is I'm one that would like to see if particularly if we've got a lot of this stuff fleshed out, is trying to keep it going, because if we can get these bills introduced early, most of the committees don't have a lot of bills coming at them, and we can get these things heard and moved along in the process fairly quickly and not run into some of the issues that we've had in the past where we got came in about the same time as the other bills and kind of got caught in the backlog, which prevented some of the things from getting through the process. So that would be my suggestion of how we might maybe be able to work on an informal way to keep things moving so that we can have a better chance of getting a number of these bills to the finish line.
Committee members, are you comfortable with a get together informally? We obviously can't take any action, but looking at these bills as they've been put together in early January, I assume that's what you mean, Representative Fisher, and then proceeding, at least if there are individuals who are willing to be the chief author of the overall bill, they can begin the process whereby they are drafted and submitted prior to the time that we actually meet. If there are amendments that the committee feels need to be made, we can always do that at a later date. Does that catch the gist of what you were thinking, Representative Fisher?
Senator Weber, you send it wonderfully. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Committee members, how do you feel about that? Is there anyone who objects?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to chime in. I think that you and Chair Fisher are onto something. I am especially interested, like you mentioned, in seeing the language before we're making any kind of formal decision. So if these two ideas could be kind of put together to make that happen, I would be supportive. So thank you for suggesting something that would allow us to see the language, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Stark, are you comfortable with that?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that's what I think I need from you. So I appreciate that. And I'll talk with Michelle Weber, the director of the LCC, and with the chairs, and we'll come up with a process.
Okay, very good. If there's nothing else regarding that issue, that's the last item, I think, as related to that, to the legislative priorities. And so we'll go to our briefing regarding the Minnesota Chloride Management Plan with MPCA staff. Who was going to be first?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. This is Greta Gauthier from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I have with me today Brooke Oslison from our staff. Go ahead, Brooke, and introduce yourself.
Hi, yeah, I'm Brooke Oslison. I've been working at the MPCA for over 13 years now, and I am the chloride coordinator for the Pollution Control Agency.
And Brooke has the PowerPoint that we sent to you last week, so if you want to bring that up, Brooke. Mr. Chairman, we'd like to just go through the PowerPoint. It's pretty short, only about 4 or 5 slides, and then we'd be happy to take any questions that members might have. So I'll turn it over to Brooke and let her go through this with you, an overview of the statewide chloride management plan.
All right, thank you, Greta. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for asking us to join you today to talk about chloride. As I mentioned, I am the chloride coordinator, so I've been working on chloride for almost my entire career at the agency in different roles. And I want to just review with you our statewide chloride management plan that we are just in the process of finalizing. We started working on this plan back in 2013 is when we finished the Twin Cities Metro Area Chloride Management Plan and started working right away on converting it or updating it to be a statewide plan that would work for all parts of our state and would address multiple sources of chloride. As you can imagine, the Twin Cities Metro Area Chloride Management Plan focused very heavily on de-icing salt, as that is the most, largest source in the metro area in particular. But there are, of course, other sources of chloride that are very important to evaluate and consider options for how do we reduce those at the source. So the main overview of this plan is to really just get us all on the same page. So it shares the current information and data that we have on chloride's impacts to the environment as well as to the infrastructure. It also covers the known water quality data that we have available from not only the MPCA, but a lot of our local partners have also collected chloride data that we were able to fold into this plan, and we run some analysis on what that data is telling us to kind of keep us all on that same page of where we're at and where we need to go to protect our water resources. We also look at the available groundwater data that we have through various organizations and entities who've looked at chloride in our shallow and our deep aquifers across our state. And then we kind of pull it all together to share what we have learned from all of our partners on what options do we have to safely reduce chloride at the source to protect our water resources. And this was really done in a very collaborative and very intense stakeholder-driven process. We had over 115 different partners and stakeholders who provided input and assisted us in creating this plan. And so we really did work with entities across our state, other state agencies, the University of Minnesota, and several other organizations who have their own little areas of expertise that we thought brought value to this plan. And so now we are at the final stages, and we're just looking for any of those. We had those last public notice comments that we received that just ended about a week ago. And then the big bulk of this is really to walk through what are some options, and so that we don't have to be prescriptive. We know that each organization, each community is going to have a different set of circumstances with not only their land use, their sources, but their budget and other important decisions that they need to make when deciding how they can best address this pollutant and protect their local waters from increased chloride concentrations. And so we lay out all possible options, what others have already done. We have a whole section dedicated to success stories of what a lot of communities have already done to safely reduce their salt use. And then we follow it up with some recommendations for here's where to look for some funding options. Here's some suggestions for how to continue monitoring as we implement some of these changes to hopefully see that progress that we're all hoping to make. So we really tried to find something for everyone in this plan. We didn't want to limit it to just, you know, winter maintenance professionals or just, you know, homeowners with their water softeners. We really looked for opportunities for a lot of different organizations and individuals who can all work together to address this toxic pollutant for our water resources. And so we really did look at all sources. So we expanded it. We got a lot more information and data on water softeners, but also dust suppressant is another common source of chloride, and as well as some other sources that are a little bit minor, but in each community, it may be their biggest source of chloride. So it was really important to cover all of the sources because every community is going to need to really focus on the sources of chloride that are having the impact to their water resources and not just, you know, that de-icing activities. Of course, our urban areas, we have a lot of examples to work from, a lot of recommendations, as well as tools. We have a smart salting assessment tool that's an online tool dedicated to help winter maintenance professionals, and we are currently, through this update of this plan, we're looking to add other sources of chloride to that tool as well to be just an additional resource to our stakeholders and our partners on how to come up with their own customized, unique implementation strategy, if you will, for how they're going to reduce chloride in their community. We also have some recommendations on how to track the progress we're making so that we can all document it and share it and be on the same page. And then, of course, as I mentioned, sharing what available funding opportunities and other resources. There's a lot of great education outreach work that's been done by our partners, other states, Canada. And we have that all pulled together in this plan so that folks can know where they need to go to if they're looking for that so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. To help us move forward a little bit quicker here to learn from what others are doing. And we have looked at what other states are doing. We have a pretty great group of states who are working on chloride, who are regularly sharing information so that we can all learn from each other to make sure that we're not missing anything and maybe some other state or Canada has come up with some really good idea that we can jump on and try to implement here in Minnesota. And so the goal is really to just help get us all on the same page. So this is a plan that is addressing the entire state, but of course it's going to, you know, need to be addressed at the local level, and so we really try to make sure we covered all of the needs from all of the communities across Minnesota. So that is my overview of the chloride management plan itself, and now I was just going to touch briefly on the funding situation. So back in FY 20 and 21, we did receive clean water funds for the chloride reduction program. And with those funds, we were able to hire a staff person at the MPCA to work with me in running our training program that historically was led through a grant with Fortin Consulting. And now that that grant has ended and there is not the opportunity to continue to utilize any grant funds, we are grateful to have this opportunity to bring over some of that administrative work and still partner with Fortin Consulting on offering this training program to our stakeholders and partners across the state. And we also had some funds that were dedicated for a water softening grant. We unfortunately, due to budget cuts this year, had to give a portion of those funds back, but I am working right now on an RFP to get the remaining funds out the door to help, I think we'll probably target it to maybe a little different audience than the community, since it's less than we had anticipated. But we are still going to get that out there to help to optimize, upgrade, or replace water softeners. And then for the coming fiscal year of 2022 and 23, there is a recommendation to support that chloride reduction program as well. And so the Clean Water Council and the state agencies are unified in that message, and we are all on the same page with the recommended budget for FY 22 and 23. And with those funds, we would be able to partially fund the Smart Salting Training Program, and I hope to be able to create additional resources and tools to help our partners in their efforts to reduce chloride at the source. And so that is all I have for the PowerPoint presentation. So I will give you that nice, beautiful image of those loons, and then I can stop sharing and we can take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Aslison. Members, are there any questions that you have? Representative Heintzeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, if the testifier could offer one. The dollars that we're talking about that are being proposed to try and continue the program, were those general fund dollars, or where? I might have missed it. I apologize if I did. And Greta, that's looks fine. Like you have the answer.
Sure, Representative Heintzeman, thank you for the question. We are again looking at the Clean Water Legacy Fund. So that's one of the legacy funds. Clean Water Legacy was where we have gotten funding in the past for this. We also in the past had been getting federal dollars through the Clean Water Act 319 grants from the federal government, but that funding has now ended for this purpose. So the Clean Water Council released their recommendations on, I think it was Monday or Tuesday of this week, and in their package was an ongoing recommendation for our smart salting program.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. That's all.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Seeing no other hands up, thank you. Or anything else, Ms. Aslison or Ms. Gauthier?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to present to your subcommittee today. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Next, I believe, was there anything else from the MPCA with Ms. Patton or Ms. Kessler, Jim, or was that all part of under this possibility of
Mr.
this?
Mr. Members, I believe that was all part of the presentation group.
Okay. Very good. With that, we'll go on next to the public waters inventory.
Mr. Chair, looking at Greta's face, maybe I missed something. So.
Oh, okay. Ms. Gauthier?
No, you did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Jim. No, you didn't miss anything. We were not sure who was going to be able to be here to testify today. So as it turned out, it was Brooke who was able to be here. So thank you for your forbearance with that.
Very good. Thank you much.
You bet.
So then we'll go to the public waters inventory. I think our first presenter on that, or did you have any preliminary comments, Mr. Stark, you wish to make?
Well, Mr. Chair, just briefly, this topic was brought up by one of our members at our last meeting, and I got some feedback and email from other committee members to discuss the issue of public waters inventory, the Limbo Creek issue in particular, and how that affects trends and flows in the Minnesota River. So me and our folks have been kind enough to be here. Bob Meyer is an assistant commissioner. Steve Colvin is the division director of ecology and water resources. Also with us today is Thomas Callahar, who is a citizen member from Olivia, I believe. So with that, I'll turn this over. I believe, Bob, you are first.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, good afternoon. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this issue with you. Steve Colvin, our Director of Ecological Water Resources, is going to go through the formal presentation. I just wanted to introduce it really quickly. I know we've been talking about this issue with several of you since we initiated our public water inventory actions within Renville and also Pope County. Steve will describe that, but unfortunately, we are in litigation with Renville County on this issue at this point in time, so we may have to stop or not be able to answer questions because of that ongoing litigation issue. So I just wanted to make sure people were aware of that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Colvin to run through the presentation, and then we can answer questions as they come up.
Very good, Mr. Meyer. Before we turn to Steve, I see that Representative Torkelson has his hand up. Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Make sure I'm unmuted here.
You are.
I brought this up at our last meeting because I knew it was going to be a hot topic. I just want to kind of reinforce what Mr. Meyer has already said, that this is under litigation, and it is controversial. But I think it's important that we as the water subcommittee have an understanding of kind of what's going on. And I do suspect that there will be some more talk about this during the legislative session. But pending the results of that litigation, of course, our discussion may be limited today, but I think it's really important that we understand what the DNR is up to here. And I'm much more interested in the process than I am about any particular watershed or stretch of drainage. Really the process. Is the process been properly established? So with that, I will let the presentation proceed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And that, do we turn to Steve Colvin?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. And I'm prepared to give a short summary of the removal and then proposed addition back to the public waters inventory for certain watercourse segments. I also have a short slideshow on Minnesota River Basin flows. So public waters are defined in statute. To clarify which waters met the definition of public waters, the DNR completed a legislatively directed inventory of those public waters in the early 80s. Waters meeting the public waters definition were placed in the public waters inventory lists and then depicted on county PWI maps. The public waters map is an important tool for landowners and DNR staff. It's critical that the inventory and PWI map are as accurate as reasonably possible. Now in 1994, the DNR was sued in Ramsey County by Trout Unlimited and others for failure to list springs, seeps, and tributaries to designated trout streams on the public waters inventory. The court found that the unnamed tributaries of designated trout streams were public waters within the meaning of the definition in statute, regardless of whether they run the PWI maps and lists. DNR subsequently entered into an agreement with plaintiffs to correct the PWI, and the court retained jurisdiction until that process was completed in 1996. There is authority in Minnesota statutes that allow the commissioner to correct errors to the original public waters inventory or to add or remove certain waters for specific reasons. In 2017, 640 miles of water courses in 70 counties were removed from the public waters inventory through a DNR commissioner's order. The changes were a result of the DNR buffer mapping project, which revealed that some water courses were not clearly identified as public waters at the time of the original inventory. At the time of the original inventory, these water courses were identified as public ditches, when in actuality, they never were included within public drainage systems. And that's something we just discovered when we received the ditch information from the public drainage authorities in the first year of the buffer mapping project. As a result of this mistaken identification as public ditches, landowners were not notified of a public water course adjacent to their property. In addition, the DNR thought they had been made part of a ditch system and were therefore principally regulated under drainage law. As I said, we discovered this was not the case, and restoring them to the PWI will clarify and give notice to the public that these water courses are regulated under public waters law. Now, there were some additional errors we encountered during the buffer mapping project, the principal of which was some errors that occurred when the original paper maps were converted to the digitized GIS layer we used for the buffer mapping project. So removal of these water courses was deemed a necessary step to go back and give proper legal notice prior to being identified on the PWI. Part of the commissioner's order stated, quote, the DNR may review the subject water courses for possible inclusion in the PWI in the future, subject to requisite public comment opportunity prior to any additions to the PWI. So what we're proposing to do now and what we've piloted or been piloting in Renville and Polk counties is to correct errors in the public water inventory by returning 4 water courses in Renville County and 1 in Polk County to the PWI. The PWI identifies which waters meet that statutory definition of public water and are regulated by the DNR for the public's benefit. We have sought a public comment on this proposal. The DNR comment period extended from August 10th, 2020 to November 30th, 2020. Findings of fact for any final order will address how the comments received were considered. Notification of revisions to the PWI will be provided to commenters, affected landowners, and county officials. A broader public notification will be made to media outlets. DNR is committed to a thoughtful and transparent process to return public water course segments to the PWI if they meet the statutory definition of public waters. This is to ensure that the PWI can be as complete as possible and accurately reflects the waters that meet the definition of a public water. In the instance of these 5 water courses, DNR has determined that all of them are altered or natural water courses, not part of a public drainage system, and that each has a total drainage area greater than 2 square miles, meeting the statutory definition of a public water course. Once returned to the PWI public waters inventory, if they're returned, for those that are returned to the public waters inventory, they would also be added to the buffer protection map and regulated under Minnesota's buffer law. DNR's process for determining whether to add these 5 water courses back to the public waters inventory was developed to ensure proper public notification and participation for any potentially affected individual. These proposed revisions to the PWI are not necessarily the only errors that need correcting within the 2 counties. DNR focused on these water courses because they represent the most significant discrepancies between public waters and what is shown on the inventory. Any remaining errors are the result of mapping issues, little technical issues that are very small and unlikely to create confusion about regulatory status. And finally, the current effort concerns only water courses that were removed from the PWI by the 2017 commissioner's order. Water courses not addressed in that order are not being considered in this process. I am open to any questions folks may have.
Mr. Colvin, Senator Weber here. One of the things that when the buffer legislation came into effect, a number of the calls that I received concerned people who weren't even aware that any of their property was in the public water inventory. And I think part of the issue that contributed to that lack of knowledge was the poor notification process that occurred in the 80s when the designation was made. As I understand, at that time, the only public notice was a blurb in the newspaper that you should check the maps or what have you, and that if there was an individual property that had a designation on their property, they never received any other type of notification. And, you know, having been in local government, if we make a zoning change, whether of any type, we have to give affected property owners within a certain distance of a property that's under consideration written notice. And so when you talk about now going back and correcting errors, are you providing written notice to affected property owners in that regard?
Senator Weber, members, yes. In this instance, we did provide riparian property notification.
Okay. All right. Very good. Representative Torkelson, your hand has stayed up. Did you have something else, or did you just forget to take it down?
Well, I think I'll just say I forgot to take it down at this point, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. And then Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I'm curious how widespread this is. Are there instances in every county? Are they all over the state? How many of these issues are out there? And like the last question, I'm a little bit concerned that there's a lot of transparency and people are understanding that this process is taking place. Can you kind of talk about how many problems you think are out there and what we're doing to make sure the public is well aware of this process?
Mr. Colvin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, or Representative, and members, we have identified 58 counties where there are potentially water courses that we may seek to add back to the public waters inventory. In any of these instances, we would engage in a process pretty much the same as what we did here. We may learn some things and identify some refinements, but there would be landowner notifications, there would be a public comment period, there would be both a public notice and a news release so that we could make sure that the public is adequately, and particularly riparian owners, are adequately informed.
Representative Poston?
Yeah, a follow-up question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we get a list of those 58 counties? I would love to see that.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, absolutely. We will get you a list.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Representative Heisman, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that this hasn't happened before, but then again, it's probably something that might have transpired in the past. And I'm wondering how, if there were errors years ago, how was that handled versus what we're looking at in terms of the process being sought today? 58 counties, I mean, that's going to impact potentially thousands, at least hundreds of people. And I too am concerned that they're not maybe aware of what's being done. So if that question could be answered, I'd really appreciate it.
Mr. Colvin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, I'm not quite sure I fully understood your question.
Mr. Chair, I'll try another way. Is it possible to take this issue to the legislature? Has that been done in the past, or is it always, because I'm sure there's been errors in the past, why is it being resolved in this way? Couldn't it be resolved through legislation where, you know, if small errors have been made, those changes could be made and people would have the opportunity to testify to the issue, and there would maybe be some more opportunities for people to speak to how this impact would be affected.
Mr. Chair,
members,
the DNR has had for a number of years authority to correct errors in the public waters inventory, and that has occurred on a small scale. The buffer mapping project brought along some complications, and we started to have to address things on a larger scale. As Senator Webber said earlier, a number of people didn't realize that waters adjacent to their property were public water courses, and some petitioned us to remove them from the PWI. And there weren't a lot of requests, certainly not in comparison to what we're talking to today, but it was greatly ramped up from the maybe one every few years to about 30 over the course of a couple of years. And we actually removed about half of those from the public water inventory. We discovered that there were errors in their original mapping and listing. So we have done that. The dilemma we faced when we got to the buffer map and this discrepancy between what public drainage authorities told us were in their systems and what we had in the public water inventory was something that we really felt like we had to address in 2017 before buffer maps on public drainage systems had to be installed. So we removed them from the list at that time to allow for that initial implementation of the buffers and to provide us with time to look into some of these water course segments more carefully.
Representative Heisman, is that?
You know, he thought my question was complicated. I think the answer is complicated. If we have had a process in the past that allowed the DNR to come to the legislature and say, hey, we have to fix these discrepancies, and that worked, why are we taking the process this direction? It seems like something's a little off here. If there was a process, something maybe was wrong, and if that could be explained, I think the testifier would have done that, but I'm not hearing that. I'm just hearing that there's a lot of them. If there's an explanation beyond that, I'd love to hear it.
Mr. Colvin?
Chair, members, the legislature provides DNR with explicit authority to make these changes and has for some time. It's just that it was very much under the radar because there were so few.
Okay. Representative Fisher, you're next.
Thank you, Chair Webber. Appreciate the opportunity. To the testifier, I have a question. You referenced that there was 640 miles of waters that were removed from the public waters inventory by commissioner order a couple of years ago in 2017. What was the process through that? Were there any public hearings? Did people have an opportunity to provide input on that? How did that all occur?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Colvin.
The DNR conducted a desktop analysis and did that as a commissioner's order. There was not a public process associated with the removal of those waters from the public waters inventory.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Weber. So does that mean we have two different processes, for one process for removing waters from the public inventory without the opportunity for public to have any input, and another process where we can add to the inventory and that has a public input on it?
Holman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the statute simply says that we can correct errors in the public water inventory. It doesn't create any rules, or I'm sorry, it doesn't have any process included with it. It doesn't have, we don't have any rules around that. Typically in the past, we have simply done it as an internal decision-making process that's reflected in revised maps that are available on the web. Because of the size of this effort on both ends, well, particularly on the adding them back in and the potential implications to riparian owners, we felt an obligation to provide a better public notification because it was more consequential.
I can understand and appreciate that's more consequential. I would think that when 640 miles of public water comes off, that's also somewhat consequential. So how do you determine, so it sounds like the process that's being used here may not always be the process used when designating a public water then, is that correct?
Mr. Colvin?
Mr. Chair, members, I would say if we were looking at an individual request for a correction of an error in a public water inventory, we would probably work closely with the requestor, but not necessarily engage in a public process. That would have to be a situation specific, I think.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Weber. I'm just struggling a little bit that it seems it's much easier to remove something from the public, appears to be able to remove something from the public waters inventory than it is to add it on, that it's causes me a little bit concerned, but I'm glad to hear that when it seems it's a larger instance that we're providing for public input. The question I would have for the Mr. Colvin is, typically when you folks have public hearings, for public input, how long of a time do you usually allow? Is it usually like 30 days or 60 days or 90 days? Typically, what is the length of time that you use?
Mr. Chair,
Colvin.
Representative, I would say typical would be between 30 and 60. We received a request to extend this particular public comment period so that farmers could get their crops out of the fields, and we did so.
Okay, thank you, Chair Weber. I want to say thank you, Mr. Colvin, for that clarification. That I appreciate you folks being flexible to make sure to meet the needs of the farmers that are out there. I think that's one of the important parts when we're having public input, that we're being accommodating the public out there. And I appreciate hearing that you folks did that modification of this in this period is substantially lengthening out the time for public input. And I want to say that's all I have for questions at this point. Thank you, Chair Weber.
Very good, Representative. Mr. Meyer, Mr. Colvin, do you have anything further at this point? I don't see any other, Representative Heintzman, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just occurred to me as we're talking about this, and maybe Mr. Colvin did spell it out and I missed it, but I'm trying to figure out what is the public interest? Why is, if you have the authority, why is the DNR moving forward with the decision to reclaim or to claim these waters as public. Is there something specifically that you're after? I don't know if that was fully explained.
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe it's in the interest of the public, particularly the property owners riparian to public waters, to be aware that they are in fact public waters. And therefore we wanted to restore them to the public waters inventory in a manner that's representative of that.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes, Representative Heintzman.
Okay, that I don't think really answered my question, honestly, because I don't understand the value that that may or may not have to the people of Minnesota. I mean, if we're talking about, for example, access to public waters, or if there was a road that needed to be maintained or something, I might get it. But otherwise, I hear you just saying that we think that the people should be aware that they're near public water. I'm really struggling trying to understand that. And I'm wondering if there's, in addition to informing that landowner that they're going to be affected, does that mean that there's additional regulations that they're going to be subject to that is going to affect their enterprise, their livelihood, or their use of the land?
Colvin?
Senator, Representative, excuse me. Because we're relying more heavily on the definition of a public water to make the determination of whether something is a public water subject to regulation by the DNR, what I'd say is if it meets definition of a public water, it would be subject to our regulation regardless. And we would prefer that landowners be aware of those things so that they can work with us on changes they might want to make to that public water that are done in a way that's protective of the water resource for all Minnesotans.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
I'm not going to ask any more questions because I feel at this point they're not being answered. I feel like that there's something missing here, and I hope that down the road there's a more robust conversation with some more detail as to why this is being pursued. This feels very strange, and I feel like there's going to be a lot of people that are negatively affected, and I still don't have a clue why we're pursuing this based on the responses and the testimony today. I'm not getting my questions answered.
Very good, Representative Heintzman. We have Representative Torkelson and then Senator Goggin, and then we are going to, when those two questions have been answered, we're going to move on to our next presenter because we have a hard stop at 4:00. So in order to get all the testifiers in, we are going to need to move forward. So at this point, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. I think we revealed that just how controversial and complicated this issue is. I think we need to put the brakes. I would hope that DNR would put the brakes on this and give us a chance to review this properly in the legislative session and take a deep dive into how this public waters inventory was established originally and why there are so many errors on it and what the proper process is for actually establishing the inventory properly. We could go on and on today, but I will cut it off at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Senator Weber. The question I have is, what's the ramifications of the landowners in that as far as real estate values are concerned? Has anybody looked at that?
Mr. Colvin?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we've not specifically looked at that question, so I don't have an answer for you.
Well, and lastly, Senator, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Goggin.
I'm in agreement with Representative Torkelson and Heintzman. I really think this needs additional discussion that's going to take longer than what we have here, and I'd like to have that opportunity to discuss this further at another date. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. With that, we are going to now turn it over to Thomas Kelleher. Mr. Kelleher, please proceed.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. My name is Thomas Kelleher. I was just a little bit about me. I was raised on a 160-acre family farm near Wadena, Minnesota. I'm one of 10 children. In 1971, I joined the U.S. Navy in order to utilize the GI Bill to go to college. And I did do that. I graduated with a degree in natural resource management. And then I managed the family farm for a couple of years. And then in 1979, I accepted a conservation technician job with the Renville County Soil and Water Conservation District. And I worked there for 35 years in numerous capacities. My major responsibilities during that time were the Wetlands Conservation Act technician, the lead technician on the Reinvest and CREP, and CREP conservation easement programs. I was the feedlot inspector at times, forester. I inspected and designed septic systems and generally assisted or personally managed federal, state, and local soil and water conservation programs. I had a pretty busy 35 years. I retired in 2015, I'm in my second term of a four-year terms of being on the Olivia City Council. So I know that water issues are not only associated with rural, but I know in the city of Olivia, we deal with water issues a lot. For those of you that don't know where I'm from Renville County, which is about 85 miles west of the cities on Highway 212. Renville County may possibly be the most drained landscape on the planet. We have about 850 miles of drainage ditch. That's more than the miles of roads that we actually have in Renville County. Subsurface drainage tile dwarfs this number. There is really no records or regulations set that tracks the amount of subsurface drainage or tile that is installed into the ground. Approximately 10 years ago, when I was still working, the Renville County Drainage Authority was estimating that we were doubling our subsurface drainage in Renville County every 2 years. That's pretty remarkable. In Renville County, we were once a water storage rich, and now we're water storage poor. 90% of all the wetlands in Renville County have been drained. Extensive tile and ditch systems have been put on the landscape. And the goal here is to get the water off the land within 48 hours to prevent any crop damage. The downstream damage by the agricultural drainage system seems to be ignored because, as everybody says here, it is legal and my right to dump the water. So the greater public has to accept the drainage the cost of that damage from downstream negative impacts. We have very little groundwater recharge in Renville County anymore, just simply because of the fact that we have drained the landscape. We've changed the hydrology of this landscape to the point where most of the drainage system is running away our water. We're storing it on top of the ground, nor are we recharging water underneath the ground. So our aquifers in the future are probably going to be depleted just simply because of the fact that we've interrupted the recharge system. Now we'll get to Limbo Creek. Limbo Creek is located in the western edge of Renville County, and it is really a wetland flowage. It's got a 9,335 acre watershed, and it encompasses four townships. It meets and always has met the definition of a public waters and should have been on the PWI map years ago, and it deserves that protection now. And I heard just with the last testimony, why the confusion over the designation? Well, It was missed under the first inventory that was back in the early 80s. And then again, it was mislabeled County Ditch 145 after a failed attempt to ditch Limbo Creek in the 1970s. And failure to correct both of these mistakes, one by DNR, one by Renville County, has compounded this issue and confused people on whether Limbo Creek is a public waters or it is a ditch 145. And again, County Ditch 145 failed, that petition failed by the landowners itself. And the on again, off again designation of a protected waters. In my career in the last 40 years, it's been on the map, it's been off the map. And so it is really kind of a bizarre situation, and it is pretty confusing even to us that have spent a lot of time looking at this issue. What needs to be brought to your attention here, guys, is that there are two real issues here. The first issue is County Ditch 77, which is actually a tile line that outlets into the floodplain of Limbo Creek. And that legal project stopped in the middle of Section 11, and this is documented. And Limbo Creek proper, what we're talking about here, was never part of that project. And there are no records of maintenance or improvements in the last 80 to 100 years. And I have been involved with Limbo Creek issues, this same issue I've been involved with for the last 40 years. And I can assure you that Limbo Creek is not and never has been a legal, organized public drainage system. Renville County Drainage Authority has no documented proof of any such designation. And in fact, the failure of the 1970 County Ditch 145 petition ended that possibility. It's not that we haven't been listening. Past efforts back in the late 90s, in a response to previous Ditch 77, that's the tile line now that the landowners are complaining about being a restricted flow. The Soil and Water Conservation District, the Minnesota Department of Ag, the Renville County Drainage Authority, the Hawk Creek Watershed Project, and others wrote a grant for $200,000+ to install two pumps on Ditch 77 in order to lift the water and discharge it onto the floodplain and into the wetlands of Limbo Creek. And we could have solved two problems there. One, we could have helped out with improving the drainage for County Ditch 77, which would have satisfied, hopefully, some of the landowners. And we also would have minimized the impacts of the water coming out of the tile system that has contaminations in it. And we would have lessened the flow for downstream mitigation. We presented that. We had about a $200,000+ grant that we actually secured. We presented that project to the landowners or the petitioners on Ditch 77, and they turned us down. And it seems like a ditch is their only answer. So now here we are in 2020 dealing with this same issue again. This is the fourth time in my career, my 35 year, now it's 40 years, that this issue has had people wringing their hands over. Now, there is some good stuff to talk about. We've had some progress. Renville County is number one in corn, number two in soybeans. But surprisingly, we are also number one in reinvest and CREP, perpetual conservation easements, wetland restorations, and buffers. And that tells me that there's a willingness out there of agricultural producers to help solve these problems and these issues that agriculture has if there's appropriate programs and adequate compensation. And the bottom line here, guys, is that we simply have to store more water on the landscape. Renville County and counties like Grenville are 90% drained. We dump all of our water as fast as we can get it into a tile line, into a drainage ditch, and into the Minnesota River, and then into the Mississippi River, and then into Lake Pepin, and then on forth to the Gulf of Mexico. The very last thing that we need in Renville County is another drainage ditch. We have 850 plus miles of those now. Limbo Creek proper needs to be on the PWI map. It should have always been there, and it was a common mistake that just simply was ignored for the last 45 years. I would like to invite anyone, either personally or as a group, if you would like, I would be more than happy to give you a tour of the area. And better yet, I would love to take you on a canoe or a kayak trip down the Minnesota River so I can show you some of the damage that this tremendous amount of water velocity, this volume of water that we are dumping into our river system and our namesake river is causing the Minnesota River. And with that, I will take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. We have a number of people who wish to testify. The testifiers have been indicated that they have 5 minutes. With the list that we have, 5 minutes apiece will take us past 4 o'clock, and that is our drop dead time, unfortunately, folks. So anyway, we're going to start out, and you've been given 5 minutes. If you can do it in less, it would be greatly appreciated. And our first testifier is Elise Larson from the MCEA.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Elise Larson. I'm a resident of Brainerd, Minnesota, and I'm currently the Water Program Director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. To begin, I would like to ground the subcommittee on the issue that we are talking about today. And that is public water. In Minnesota, public waters are held in trust for the people, for the ordinary purposes of life. Our public health, our economy, and our way of life are inextricably tied to the public's access to and the protection of public water. And this subcommittee needs to remember what is at stake if public water protections are undermined. I would like to speak directly about the water course that we are discussing today. After generations of ditching and draining wetlands, Limbo Creek is now the only largely unaltered water course in all of Renville County. Limbo Creek is a free-flowing stream with a drainage area of over 14 square miles that flows directly into the Minnesota River, a river that has suffered perpetual damage from past drainage practices. Throughout the Limbo Creek watershed, there are numerous wetland complexes that provide water storage and clean the water before it enters the Minnesota River. And importantly here, Limbo Creek has never been part of Renville County's public drainage system. Applying these facts, Limbo Creek is a public water, and DNR is properly taking steps to ensure Limbo Creek is afforded the public water protections governed by Minnesota law. Here, DNR has opened and closed a 109-day comment period with notice mailed directly to landowners. This is an unprecedented level of due process, given that in 2017, DNR removed 640 miles of public water with no notice or opportunity to comment. DNR is not the first to recognize the importance of Limbo Creek. In fact, in 2013, the Renville County Water Management Plan made the following finding. In order to manage natural resources and increase biodiversity and recreational opportunities, Renville County needs to maintain and protect high-quality reaches of natural waterways such as Limbo Creek and pursue grants to protect Limbo Creek through permanent easements. Renville County's recent actions conflict with their stated policy that Limbo Creek should be protected. Here, DNR has the authority and the obligation to protect public waters in this state. Responding briefly to some earlier questions, the public has never gone to the legislature to correct errors in the inventory. Rather, DNR has the authority under Minnesota Statute Section 103G.201 to correct errors in the inventory. I thank the subcommittee for continuing to support public water protections in Minnesota for current citizens and for future generations. This concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. And to the future testifiers here, I just want to comment that the Limbo Creek issue is in front of the courts. This committee is not going to be making any decisions as it relates specifically to Limbo Creek. And so please keep that in mind. And please confine your comments to the public waters inventory in a general sense, and we will go on from there. With that, Mr. Sparlin, Executive Director for the Mississippi River Congress.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Scott Sparlin. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for a Clean Minnesota River and coordinator of the Minnesota River Congress. So make that correction, not Mississippi. I live in the heart of the Minnesota Valley here in New Ulm in Brown County. The organizations I work for have been advocating on behalf of clean water and our state's namesake river for the past 31 years. We have sat through decades of countless meetings of all shape and size in this regard, hosted by every possible government and non-government entity known who deals with water. We have heard innumerable reports on years of science findings from a multitude of researchers working on behalf of numerous business and government entities. It has been quite enlightening and has served as a reflection on how our actions regarding water affect the greater society, often with winners and losers. One thing is clear after all these years of study, in order to achieve clean, usable, and societally acceptable water quality, we will have to store more water on the landscape and make our first, second, and third order streams, which feed into our larger tributaries, act more as they historically did before alterations on the landscape began. I believe this lawsuit challenge is based on the flawed genesis of 1918 was the beginning of time for this area of the state, that by allowing this project, we will simply be putting things back to where they were, and that this is not an improvement, but merely a maintenance project. We cannot simply continue to gut and straighten out every little remaining semblance of nature attempting to heal itself in the name of removing more water and sending it downstream to others who don't want it all at once. We are simply exacerbating our very normal floods and droughts by continuing this unfettered, ill-advised type of action. It remains true that artificial drainage is necessary for our current choice in agricultural production, as well as our local economy's abilities to sustain and thrive. However, we can no longer ignore the societal costs to our various adversely affected infrastructures downstream, such as various costs to cities, rural roads, bridges, public utilities, and losses to businesses such as recreation, tourism, and other types of farming operations. We are not interlopers poking our nose into someone else's business. This is a statewide issue. Members of this committee are aware of the need for water storage, and together, along with some of those members, we have been developing potential legislation that will target water storage actions on the landscape. That could be very promising. It already has substantial support in the public landscape. If we put our collective heads together and in the future develop products and projects that will mimic natural water flow in our streams, it will in turn provide for stabilized flows, groundwater recharge, and cleaner surface water in our lakes, rivers, and streams. We intuitively know this as Minnesotans who cherish our water resources. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on this to you, to the committee, and thank you, Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Sparlin. And with that, we will now turn to Tom Wolner of the Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance. Mr. Wolner.
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm Tom Wolner, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance. My wife and I have lived on Lake Pepin, which is just south of Red Wing, for the past 20 years. During this time, we've actually witnessed 200 years of lake sedimentation taking place. I say this because we know that the lake is filling in at a rate that's 10 times the natural rate. The great majority of this material, 90% on any given year, originates from the Minnesota River and its tributaries. This high flow rate of sediment is caused by powerful erosion due to rapid drainage in the Minnesota River Basin. We've seen many changes to the lake as a result. Local bays and channels that not long ago were navigable for boating, hunting, or fishing are now filled in. Boat access to river towns like Bay City and Maiden Rock are nearly completely blocked by sediment, even when using a small fishing boat. Instead of only seasonal flooding, we're now seeing more frequent high water throughout the summer. When there's a heavy rain event in southern Minnesota, within about a week, we see the lake level rise. This frequent high water, in addition to increased sediment, is eroding away trees, vegetation, and lakeshore. And of course, water quality is often less than inviting for activities like swimming or water skiing. Without better management of upstream water, research suggests that one third of Lake Pepin's volume, it's a 26,000 acre lake, will be filled in within the next 80 years instead of 800 years. You may be thinking, well, Minnesota has plenty of lakes, so what's the big deal? But Lake Pepin is important for many reasons, including ecological, historical, recreation, and for economic vitality of the towns and communities that surround it. It deserves attention and protection. Which brings me to Limbo Creek. Lake Pepin needs waterways like Limbo Creek, those waterways that work naturally to help manage upstream water. We think that the DNR is right, and we, Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance, fully support their efforts and authority to correct waterways inventory, including Limbo Creek. Limbo Creek should be afforded the environmental protections of a public water. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Wolner. And the
Mr. Chair. Next,
Mr. Yes.
I've inadvertently missed one of the testifiers, Peg Furlong.
Okay.
Could you introduce her now, please?
I will turn it over to Peg Furlong, property owner. Ms. Furlong, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. First of all, I would like to start out by thanking the members of the Legislative Subcommittee for the policy to take time to hear our concerns today about Limbo Creek. As was stated, my name is Peg Furlong, and I, along with my husband and family, are landowners. We live in the Hawk Creek Township at 83107 150th Street. Limbo Creek flows through our section where our land is located. I will begin with the fact that as landowners, we are supportive of Limbo Creek being returned to the public waters inventory and the DNR's oversight to make these corrections. This situation has shed light on a bigger problem in our governing system in rural places. As residents living in a rural county in Minnesota, we want and believe there is a great need, as demonstrated by this meeting today, for state oversight of our water and natural heritage. By the actions of local drainage authority and Renville County board members, it leads us to believe that they don't recognize the authority of the state, the DNR, or MPCA in making decisions such as these that impact the overall health of our watershed. The sheer fact that they met and decided to move forward with dredging the wetland fully knowing that we were in the middle of a public comment period and a hearing was scheduled that they should have waited represents a troubling lack of respect for due process and that Renville County is part of a larger system. There lacks a clear respect for state governance and oversight. I know that it is a two-way street, and sometimes people in rural places don't feel like they are heard, but the DNR and MPCA have been coming out to rural Minnesota, holding hearings, taking comments, and trying to get to the bottom of local concerns. When the process does not go the way a few local landowners want, they blatantly disregard the process and do what they want to do anyway. The landowners contesting the DNR and acknowledging Limbo Creek as part of a public waters inventory are significant landowners are by the statement, well, I'm going to pass on that because I don't have time. At one time, the landscapes in southwestern Minnesota was covered with wetlands and they've been dredged up and plowed. What few wetlands are left, such as near Limbo Creek, are left and function as filters. They slow the water down, they filter contaminants that come off of adjacent land farm fields, and they clean the water before it hits the Minnesota and all the communities downstream. If we dredge these wetlands, those contaminants just move downstream and are a problem for others and ultimately taxpayers to address. In previous hearings, the Drainage Authority of Renville County held, I was part of the hearings, and they stated they want to return the drainage system to peak historic levels, the peak flow to historic levels. But the white elephant in the room is for the past 30 years, as by testimony of Mr. Kalahar earlier, the amount of tiling and substrate drainage has increased tenfold, increasing the peak flows and flooding downstream. Letting these gentlemen of Renville County dredge yet another wetland for a local fix that benefits a few farm owners at the expense of taxpayers and not solving the larger problems is not a good use for our taxpayer dollars and is not sustainable. As a landowner, a farmer, and a parent, I want water policy that is going to protect the interests of all Minnesotans. Our water should be held in public trust for everyone and for future generations to come. Water is our legacy in Minnesota, and we need to protect it. We need to send a clear message that because someone owns a piece of land, it does not give them the right to do what they want with the water. We have a responsibility to leave our water and our land better than we found it. Lastly, I would say, just in summary, we need to protect our natural heritage when local control fails the process, to follow the process and the law. The state needs to step in the best interest of all Minnesotans. Number two, elected officials who depend on salaries that these positions offer might not be the best people to be making local decisions that have such an impact on all of Minnesota and taxpayers. Number three, decisions about water need to support healthy ecosystems and watersheds, not just 2-mile stretches to be drained for farmland purposes. In an abyss of conventional agriculture, we need to support what little is left of our natural areas. Making policy that serves individual personal financial gain over public trust is not sustainable. There are many farmers that care for the land and are regeneratively farming in ways that promote soil health and protection and storage of water on the land as referred to earlier in testimony. Unfortunately, there are not enough of them. As legislators on water policy, I'd ask you to support programs that push regenerative farming practices and partner with your colleagues on agriculture committees. Farmers should be encouraged to hold water on their land and increase soil health. Artificial systems of water management.
You've used your 5 minutes. I think you need to move on. So,
can I just finish my last sentence? Please. I would say artificial systems of water management do not make sense and they are not sustainable. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Next, we will turn to Ted Suss, of the Executive Director of the Friends of the Mississippi Valley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to testify. The first thing I'd like to do is correct the title that you generously bestowed upon me. I am Executive Director of the Friends of the Minnesota Valley, not Friends of the Mississippi.
Very good. Thank you.
I live on a small farm in Redwood County, which is right across the river from Renville County and competes with Renville County every year for being the largest producer of corn and soybeans in the state of Minnesota. And like Renville County, Redwood County is highly drained. Directly across the road from the end of my driveway is a straight as an arrow ditch, which originally was a meandering stream. As Ms. Larson alluded to earlier, the public waters belong to the people of Minnesota, and it's incumbent upon all of us, and in particular those of you in policymaking positions, to protect those public waters for future generations. Previous legislators and legislatures have established the public water inventory law, and it's important that the Department of Natural Resources, which has been charged with the difficult responsibility of enforcing that law, it's extremely important that they be supported in making the difficult decisions that they have made and that they are about to make. We all realize that this is extremely complex, that property owners, I keep hearing some background
One second, Mr. Suss. Will someone mute their phone, please? Because quite frankly, you have a conversation that's trying to come through. So please proceed, Mr. Suss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lost my train of thought there for a second. We support the right of farmers and landowners to use their land, and when necessary, to drain that land if they want to get maximum production. But that water, when it leaves their land, doesn't go harmlessly away. All of us are downstream from somebody. I can point to farmers in Lyon County, in Redwood County, in Renville County, whose land is inundated with water because people upstream, farmer owners upstream, have increased the drainage on their land. The public waters, which have been diminished significantly in this last century, serve a function for storage, filtration, and to mitigate the rapid rise and fall of the stream levels when we get a heavy rain. You know, there's a small town southwest of here in Mr. Torkelson's district, Springfield, which every time there's a heavy rain, the Cottonwood River floods and a significant portion of Springfield goes underwater. We have people in the Shakopee area whose property goes underwater every time there's a heavy rain. Protecting the public waters is something that is extremely important, and I would beseech the legislature and the legislative members of this committee to realize that you've given the Department of Natural Resources an incredibly difficult job, forced them to make some incredibly difficult decisions, which by definition are going to make some people angry and other people happy. But the Public Waters Inventory Law, which has been on the books for a few decades now, is protecting an extremely valuable resource that needs to be protected. We can't just dump more water faster into the streams and not expect it to have a negative impact downstream, which may not be all the way to Lake Pepin. It might be right here in Redwood County. I paddle the Minnesota River and the Redwood River and the Cottonwood River on a regular basis. It's almost impossible to get on and off the river at public landings because the silt has built up to the point that your feet will stick into mud for a foot to 18 inches before it hits the concrete ramps. So protecting public water is something that we need to do. And I would encourage you to examine carefully both sides of these issues and not just look at how fast can we move the water if we only install another drainage system. End of my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Suss. Next, we are moving on to to, I believe, Seaver Peterson, farmer from Shakopee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, my name is Seaver Peterson. I'm 76 years old. I'm third generation on the farm here in Eden Prairie area. We also farm into Carver and Scott and Sibley counties. Not that it's any grandiose, the little pieces here in the River Valley over the years. Part of that started with my grandfather, who had a home on the riverbank of the Minnesota River. That would be unthinkable today. It's not even legal to do that. People would imagine that that cannot possibly be done, and it cannot be done today with the flooding that we're receiving here in the Minnesota River Valley at this time. But it was possible. I say this to say that my grandfather wasn't the only one. There were other homes up and down the river valley. I have a piece of property here, actually, that I bought after I came home from Vietnam, and it's in the river valley, and it had a commercial business on it before I owned it, and it's in the valley floodplain. But that business had been closed for a number of years. And probably some of it was due to flooding that had been happening, even as we've increased the drainage of Western Minnesota. But I'm here today. I just want to put a face and a voice to the downstream situation. I heard it mentioned today in some of the prior testimony, and it's. I'm afraid that it's a forgotten side of drainage. What happens to those of us downstream. And everybody except the top person in the watershed is a downstream receiver of the water. But I'm a farmer and I get it. I understand the benefits of tile drainage and what it does to property. I heard property values today mentioned. There's not an advertisement that I get about property values that doesn't, or land for sale, but one of the highlights it's just been pattern tiled or recently tiled as though that adds value, which it does to producer farmers like me for the production. But I think all of us have to work together and consider the state and the water itself and what we're doing to those that are downstream from us, such as my family here. But I'm here to say that it is destroying our river valley. It's destroying our wetlands here. We are concerned here in Eden Prairie. That's where I was born and raised, in Eden Prairie Township. It's not a township of farmers anymore. It's now a city. There's few of us farmers left. But it's destroying our lakes here. These wetlands in the valley here are considered the pearls of Prairie. Our most popular park is adjacent to and looks out over the river valley and these lakes. But though our woods are being destroyed down there, they're being killed off with more and more frequent flooding, and they come much faster because of all of the drainage we have in Minnesota. Anyway, I don't have to go on about that. I want to put a face and a name. And I'm telling you that this indiscriminate or improperly managed drainage of Western Minnesota has destroyed and is continuing to destroy our family's economic life as we've known it here in the valley. Thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to testify.
Senator, you're muted.
Hi, this is David Mingy.
Yes, former Congressman Mingy, please proceed.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Weber. It's an honor to appear before your committee. My name is David Mingy. I lived for almost 30 years in Lacapraw County in the Montevideo area, very close to the Minnesota River. This afternoon, I'm speaking on behalf of the Isaac Walton League of Minnesota. It has 16 chapters in our state and hundreds of members. Everybody has talked about the importance of water and public water. I would like to emphasize that the DNR is critical to the protection of these public water areas in Minnesota. Otherwise, the regulation of drainage and this water going into our river system is a county matter. And of course, historically, at the local level, we've viewed water as the common enemy. And the question is, how do we get rid of it? And we see it from the perspective of the people where the water comes out of the sky, where it falls. And the trouble with that is that the downstream interests are not represented. The DNR is crucial to representing and identifying these downstream interests. And that, of course, creates controversy. The DNR is in the middle of a very difficult and contentious proceeding. The Isaac Walton League is supportive of the DNR and thanks the DNR for taking this strong interest in public waters in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman. To the final three testifiers, Mr. Schecker, Tenike, and Thomas, we are not going to be able to continue on for your verbal testimony. I would ask that you submit in writing your comments to Mr. Stark, and he will in turn send that to us. Mr. Stark, unless you have any final comments, we really do need to shut this Zoom meeting down to live by our agreed upon times.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And members, thank you. I'll be in touch with those who we did not have a chance to. I apologize for that. And we'll get that information out to all the members in due order. So thank you.
Very good. With that, everyone, this meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.